This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Russ White.
I'm Russ White for MSU Today. Albert Ratner graduated from Michigan State University with a Bachelor's of Science in Forestry in 1951, and he's a 2012 Distinguished Alumnus from the MSU Alumni Association.
Well, I feel being honored by MSU is a real honor for me because it was such an important part of my life. I actually only spent 2 years of my college at MSU, but I was married in the second year to my late wife. It was probably the best year of my life ever, and it was just a phenomenal experience. It was so far ahead of its time with foreign students. John Hanna was such a gifted individual, and you just felt great. I had come out of the Army, enlisted after the war, and I didn't have a bad day in all the time. I haven't had many bad days since, but it was just a fantastic experience, and it's always a wonderful thing if you're from Ohio to be honored from Michigan. That's special.
Mr. Ratner says it was his father who gets the credit for his ending up at MSU.
When I graduated from high school, the war had just ended, and I always thought I'd be in the Army, but I had a basketball scholarship to Western Reserve. So I played basketball in high school and went to Western Reserve University, and at the end of that semester, I enlisted in the Army, where I also ended up playing basketball. When I was out of college, my family was in the lumber business, and I didn't want to go to college. I'd worked in the business, and I just said to my dad, I don't want to go to college anymore. I've seen enough of life, and I want to get into the business. And he said, well, you have to go to college. And I said, I'm not going. He said, what if I could find you a college that had a course in lumber? And of course, I knew no such college existed. So I made it. I said, yeah, if you can find me that kind of a university, I'll go. A week later, he gives me this green book from Michigan State University and says they have a course in lumber merchandising and lighthouse construction. I said, Dad, they don't need lighthouses. That's for boats. He said, you're going. That's how he ended up at Michigan State.
Mr. Ratner is co-chairman emeritus of the board of Forest City Enterprises, a commercial and residential real estate entity that he's been a part of since 1951. The company's mission is simple, to build communities.
Well, when I was out of college, I knew Detroit pretty well. So we were among the earliest people in the shopping center business. And we were doing some apartments, so some of the first apartments I did were in Detroit, Michigan. We did Trolley Plaza. We did a piece of Millinder Center. But we ended up in the lumber business, which we had been historically. Then we developed lots. And from the lots, we started doing mixed unit developments. And so we did a lot of shopping centers. One of our big programs behind me are all these shovels. We build 86,000 housing units for senior citizens, 5,000 in Michigan. And we did the program, interestingly enough, with George Romney, who was the head of HUD at the time and did Operation Breakthrough. And we were really the major survivor out of it and did housing all over the country, Florida, California, and all over. So that was one of our great businesses because it's so wonderful to do housing for seniors. Since that time, we've branched out pretty much around the country, very little overseas. But we do major projects in the country. We've done the New York Times building. This week, we're opening up the arena in New York, Barclays, where the Nets will be playing. We've done Stapleton Airport, the old airport. Halfway through, we have 16,000 people living there. We're doing the yards in Washington, D.C., a part of the original naval yards. So our basic business is to build places where people can live, work, and play, and a lot of large mixed-use projects. It's a wonderful business because the things you do make people happy. They're the most important things in their life, living in housing, shopping. One of our great businesses now is military housing. where we're partners with the government. We have about 15,000 units around the country, a lot at Pearl Harbor. And you go to Pearl Harbor and you redo the houses and you put solar panels on the roof. It's exciting. I'm one of the few people that have gotten to do in my old age what I wanted to do when I was a little boy. And a lot of it, I can't say that I attribute it to Michigan State per se, but in the continuum that was my life, it, I think, was the one place that reinforced what my parents taught me, which is you can be anything you want to be, but you have to do it. And my mother had a saying that you can do anything you want to do if you don't care who gets credit. And I look at Michigan State as a modest university. For all the great things that it does, it is, in my view, very much overstated. And that's part of its greatness. Because once you think you're great, there's nothing left. But if every day you're trying to become greater, then you have a future.
Ratner says ultimately Forest City is about finding out where people are, where they want to be, and to develop a plan to help them get there. Mr. Ratner is a proponent of immigration and says poverty is unacceptable.
Our business basically is building communities. So if you look at most of the places that we've gone, we've not gone in the best places of the country or what people would consider the best places, but rather the places of distress. And it came about basically because we were shifting from a lumber business into a different business, and all the hotshot developers could get all the good projects. So we looked at doing Millinder Center when there wasn't much at Millinder Center, and going to New York and doing a project called Metrotech, building the first office building in Brooklyn since World War II. So the projects basically have been city projects or inner city projects where you have tremendous involvement with the neighbors and the neighborhoods. And because they've been depressed because of events that have taken place, we can't go in and tell people what to do. Our goal is to find out what people would like to be like. I describe my business simply, which is what we have to do is find out where people are, where they want to be, draw a line between the two, and develop a plan to try to help them get there. But our whole life is communities. And we have a saying which says, our heart is where our communities are. So while my home is Cleveland and I love it, I love Denver, I love Washington, I love Richmond, Indiana. I kid everybody, we've been in the Big Apple and the Little Apple, which are New York City and Manhattan, Kansas. So we just love communities. We love being involved with people. The promise of America, I come from immigrant, my dad was an immigrant. The promise of America always has been that the people who came here, while they received a great deal, brought more with them than they ever took away when they left. So I'm a very strong believer in, number one, immigration. I think it's vital to this country. It's made the country. Second thing, I spend enormous of my time in the inner city in minority communities. There will be a tremendous job shortage. Not job shortage, there'll be a tremendous shortage of people to fill the jobs that we're going to have. And the only people who are not employed are going to be people who are minorities. They're going to become the majority of the people in this country. So for someone to think that people living in poverty is acceptable is dead wrong. Our future will depend, the mayor of Cleveland, Frank Jackson, says it so well. What happens to the most of us is what will end up happening because of what happened to the least of us. And the idea that we have this tremendous disparity of wealth comes about not so much on the upside that people are doing well, but on the downside that we have a group of people that aren't doing well. My belief after spending a lifetime in those communities, for the largest part, they're not there because they want to be there. They're there because they don't have the education. They're there because they have single-parent mothers who are good people but may not be educated. They're there because as a society, we accept the fact that that's a way of life. And we can't change them. They need to change themselves. But the one thing that you learn when you spend time in this business is you take these kids and you put them in a good education system. I have one young lady that went to a school that our family started, had a 4-year scholarship to Hodgkin's. She just started at Yale this past week. You can't make that up. But that's what America's all about. That's what Michigan State is all about. It's a land-grant college. It was put here to see that we help people help themselves. So I think, you know, if I were asked what I enjoy the most about the business, is just sitting with people and looking at problems. And I think the other thing that's important is that when you go to college, you learn a lot of things, and you take statistics, and you take a lot of theory. But the real thing you have to do in a business is you have to be able to try to look at what's taking place and come up with the question. There's always a question. There's always a big question. And the question for me, for education and poverty, it's a word my mother used. Is that acceptable to us as Americans? And my answer is no. We don't believe that's the way people should live. On the other hand, I don't believe by giving things to people that you make it better. But by working with people, by understanding people, you have an opportunity to change the world. Probably the greatest thing that happened to me is the fact that I'm Jewish. And it's the greatest thing because in our culture, what we're taught is we have to do tikkun olam, we're to save the world. And if you think about saving the world, it's impossible. But they give us a way out. They say you cannot save the world, but you cannot desist from trying. I think what Michigan State is about, I think what I'm about, what our company is about, we just keep trying to do better, trying to make things better.
Ratner says MSU reinforced everything his parents and sister taught him and led to his deep appreciation for Midwestern values.
I was very fortunate because my nuclear family was my mother, father, and sister. My mom was born in this country, my dad in Europe, and they brought together the finest attributes you could ever find in the world. And I had a wonderful education at home, and I had a great high school experience. But life is a continuum. When you leave your home and you go to college, the question is, does it change your life forever, or does it continue and reinforce the things you believed in? In the case of Michigan State, everything my mom and dad taught me and my sister taught me were things that Michigan State reinforced. The fact that at that time, blacks, we called them blacks at that time, and whites were living together, that kids were going overseas to study, that people from outside the world were coming to study. And we had a leader in John Hanna that made you understand what leadership was. So what Michigan State did for me was two things. One, it reinforced everything my parents had taught me. And the second thing it did for me, and this is going to sound very snobbish, it made me believe that Midwestern values are wonderful things. Because I might not have been able to go to other colleges in the country, but kids, my family, they've been all over the country. But I will tell you, the kids that go to Michigan State, in my view, and I've done some lecturing there, those are real kids. Those are not kids who think they're entitled to something. They're kids who want to earn what they get. I believe in earning what you get. So it's played a tremendous role in what happens to you in your own mind. You leave the campus, but the campus never leaves you. So still a part of me, and I'm still a part of it.
Albert Ratner describes the difference between making a living and making a life.
I do a lot of lecturing at colleges, and the last lecture that I gave was a lecture in which I said to these kids, I'm going to give you two speeches. One is how to make a living. The second is how to make a life. And the answer is, it's easy to make a living if that's all you want to do. Just concentrate on making money, it's easy. There's no satisfaction in that. If you make a life, then you can make a living. So you should never let, when you have a decision to make about what job to take, don't take the one that gives you the most money. Take the one that gives you the most opportunity. And when you're doing business with somebody else, don't only think of the opportunity for you. Think of the opportunity that you give to somebody else. You live three lives. You live a family life, you live a business life, and you live a community life. And my mom explained to me, it was hard to believe at the time, but my mom explained to me that the most important of those were the family. And the next important was the community, and last the business. I said, Mom, that doesn't make any sense. And she said, look, if things are wrong with your family, I don't care how good everything else is. You cannot be happy. If somebody is sick, if one of the kids has a drug problem, it tears you apart. You can't live with that. If you have a good family, but you're in a community that's falling apart, how safe is your family? What satisfaction can you have in living in a family that everything is going badly? If you have a great family in a good community, can you have a wonderful business? I've been blessed with a wonderful family, the communities that we've worked with. So the business has been very natural and very rewarding for me.
That's 2012 Michigan State University Alumni Association distinguished MSU alumnus Albert Ratner. You can learn more about Mr. Ratner and Forest City Enterprises at forestcity.net. I'm Russ White for MSU Today.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. We've all heard the expression, it's all about who you know. And wherever you are on your career ladder, having a friend on the inside can make all the difference. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, you're instantly connected to 500,000 Spartans around the world, many of whom are key decision makers in just about every major enterprise. Whether you're looking for a way in or a way up, your MSU Alumni Association affiliation can help you link up with that MSU alum who'll always take your call just because you're a Spartan. Building your network right now before you need it is the best possible career insurance, and joining the MSU Alumni Association is the best possible way to get the most out of your Spartan life. Learn more online at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, it's a real pleasure to welcome to the program someone who is passionate about water and about how we need to do a much better job of managing that precious resource. He is Robert Glennon, Regents Professor and Morris K. Udall Professor of Law and Public Policy at the University of Arizona. Also author of the widely read Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It, which was published in April of 2009 by Island Press. Robert was recently in Michigan as part of the MSU Distinguished Lecture Series on Water, talking about water shortages and solutions. Professor Glennon, the title of your book is a really good place to start. Water shortages, America's unquenchable desire for water. What is the problem and why do we have it?
Oh, great question, Kirk. And the problem is that water is a finite resource, and we're using water in ways that are literally using it up. The best example is groundwater pumping. The water that's in our aquifers, it took Mother Nature hundreds or sometimes thousands of years to accumulate, but in many instances we're pumping it out in mere decades.
And America's unquenchable thirst, it sounds like we have some behaviors that we need to change in the United States of America, let alone peoples around the world.
Well, the demand comes from a variety of sources, and some of the demands are fairly frivolous. There are showers that Kohler now puts out that have 10 shower heads, each with the force of water to take paint off walls. Bottled water is, I think, pretty narcissistic. But there are also demands that are very important. The demand for energy, for example, and the requirements of water for producing energy are enormous. And the best example of that is ethanol. But even solar energy for concentrating solar thermal takes a lot of water. And we need, as you know, so much more energy in the United States. Just look at what companies like Google do with their data centers to run their algorithm. Each of those centers puts about the same amount of demand on the energy supply as a good-sized city. And there are now tens of thousands of these centers around the country, and all of them need water for cooling.
Now, if I remember my science correctly, this H2O molecule, that which has been created is all we're ever going to have, but it cannot be destroyed. Water can take different forms. So is the problem really more with growing population and greater use of water, or do we need to figure out ways somehow, scientifically, to produce more H2O?
Well, you do remember your science correctly, and we're not going to produce more H2O. What we have, we have. We're drinking the same water as the dinosaurs. And the problem is that as we, well, think, for example, of Los Angeles. Every time a toilet handle moves in Los Angeles, as much as 6 gallons of water end up in the Pacific Ocean. And that water won't be available until the hydrologic cycle comes around again, which could take scores or hundreds of years. So the real problem is that the water isn't where we need it, when we need it, in the form that we need it.
Part of the problem, Robert, is, too, that we're trying to do things in parts of the country. I think of the Central Valley in California, down in your neck of the woods in Arizona, specifically with agriculture, where the desert needs to bloom. And in order for the desert to bloom, I mean, that takes an inordinate amount of water.
You're absolutely right. Farmers use between 70% and 80% of every western state's water. And we need to think about that. And what I've proposed is let's set up a demand offset system. And so that is if you want to put a new demand on the public supply, think of our public supply as a giant milkshake glass. And think of each demand as a new straw in the glass. If you want to put a new straw in that glass, you need to persuade someone else to take her straw out of the glass. And that's really happening. What you're seeing is a market for water beginning to develop where developers, cities, industry come to farmers and say, look, we'll pay you to modernize your infrastructure. We'll pay you to improve your irrigation efficiency. And the farmers have readily done that.
Yeah, agriculture does. And I think, granted, agriculture, a lot of different commodities use vast amounts of water. But farmers have also had a history of being innovative, bottom line oriented, entrepreneurial. Trickle irrigation, you mentioned irrigation systems as an example of water conservation. Question is, how can farmers do this in areas like dairy, for example, or cash crops? And then you have this whole issue, as you mentioned earlier, of ethanol production. Some real challenges in terms of water conservation and use.
Absolutely. It can be done, but it's very expensive. That's why I think we need to look to the people who want new amounts of water to pay for the retrofitting of the existing systems. More than half of the irrigation water in the United States is done with flood irrigation. It's the least efficient form imaginable. So let's put in place center pivots, or even if you have center pivots, let's move to drip, as you mentioned, Kirk, or micro irrigation. There are a lot of ways to use the water better.
In your book, you talk about Las Vegas and fountains and all sorts of, I presume you would say, abusive use of water.
Well, yes, in one way. The idea of a fountain in the middle of the Mojave Desert sending water 250 feet into the sky is pretty bizarre. But what's surprising, and the reason I start with Las Vegas, is that all that water is recycled. And the funny thing about the Strip is it only uses 3% of Las Vegas' water, and yet it is the economic driver in the state, second to none.
Las Vegas, and again, as an example, I mean, they have made some they've got a water czar there, I understand, that is pretty progressive, I mean, and maybe in your view as well, compared to water czars in other parts of the country, like Atlanta, or maybe here, even here in Michigan. You mentioned that they're recycling a lot of water in Vegas. Is Vegas moving in the right direction in terms of water policy?
Absolutely. And their czar, as you call her, is Patricia Mulroy. She's a fiery redhead. She's just lots of fun. And she's had a conversion. She was sanguine about their hopes for a while, and now she realizes that Las Vegas has run out of water. One of the things they're doing, they are paying people to rip out their lawns. And they have put their money where their mouths are. They have spent $200 million paying people to convert from turf to xeriscaping, native vegetation. So I start with Las Vegas because despite their naughty slogan about what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, when it comes to water, they're the future. What they're doing, we're all going to be doing.
Well, let's talk a minute. In your own backyard, I've had a couple trips to Arizona in the last couple of years. I've noticed now that Arizona is making some major strides. Native vegetation and landscaping around new housing, for example, is law. I mean, maybe you've had something directly to do with that in your capacity.
Arizona, when it comes to water, is pretty progressive. And I say that advisedly because it's not very often you can use the words Arizona and progressive in the same sentence. But we have pioneered for reusing water, recharging water, water banking. Water harvesting is a big deal now, particularly where I live in Tucson, less so in Phoenix. But in Tucson, you'll drive around. You'll seldom see a lawn. You'll see rain harvesting barrels. You'll see xeriscaping. It's just really in the DNA of the city of Tucson now.
You were recently in Michigan. You have some strong Michigan roots. Let's talk a little bit about the Great Lakes. You're aware of a major water research initiative at Michigan State University. We have the Office of the Great Lakes here in Michigan, et cetera. What do we need to do from a policy standpoint, and what are we doing in terms of conserving what is really an amazing freshwater resource?
Well, it's so good to be back in Michigan. I've got dear friends here. I spent wonderful years teaching at Wayne State, so I have very fond memories. I have one overriding impression about my trip here this time, and that is that you still do not have control over how much groundwater is being pumped. And it is really open sesame on that resource. It's not even necessary to have a permit to drill a well unless you're going to pump more than 100,000 gallons of water per day, and then you need a permit. And in the last year, there have been permits given out for more than 600 commercial-scale wells. They're going to be almost all irrigation wells, and that's just the beginning. What's happening is, in response to this horrible drought, farmers are turning around and saying, we need to go the route of Western farmers and start to irrigate. And irrigation is a game-changer when it comes to water. So you need to close the loopholes. That's the policy change that's absolutely essential. You cannot let there be such open access to a finite resource. Once a well is drilled, it's going to be very difficult to have that well turned off. And right now, the opportunity is there for people to drill new wells, and by golly, that's the direction they're going in. So that if I had one recommendation, it would be to get your hands around this permissive rule. The rule is called reasonable use. There's nothing reasonable about it. It's an oxymoron of the first order.
You know, back to your excellent analogy about taking one straw out, if you're going to put one straw in that milkshake, really would certainly apply in terms of water use in the Great Lakes.
It is. I mean, people think of the Great Lakes who don't know that much about it and think, oh, well, it's an infinite supply. But the truth is it's only 1% or 2% renewable. And take a look at what the Soviet Union did to the Aral Sea. And it's a reminder that the same thing could happen here, particularly because groundwater is connected to surface water. And so when you pump so much groundwater, you're going to reduce the discharge to the Great Lakes. And that's something that Michigan should be very concerned about.
Let's turn for a moment while we have time to a national policy. I'm not as familiar with policy, with water policy as I am with energy policy, but if water policy nationally is similar to our energy policy or lack thereof, then we really have some work to do in Washington. Maybe you could enlighten me on where are we nationally with the national water policy?
It's worse than our energy policy. Because take a look at ethanol. I mean, Congress prescribed we should produce 36 billion gallons of biofuels in 10 years without giving even a moment's thought to how much water it would take to do that. It's really – and so what's stunning now is that we are importing oil and exporting ethanol. That's madness.
You recently had an opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal about how we're exporting water to China – in the form of alfalfa bales.
Absolutely. That surprised even me, and I've been working in the field of water for a while. But it's a brand-new export market. And the disconnect between national trade policy, which encourages farmers to send water to China in the form of bales of alfalfa, but simultaneously prohibits those farmers from selling the water to nearby Las Vegas, is fairly bizarre. So what we think is, we think that if we're going to send alfalfa to China, let's first feed it to some cows, produce the milk, process the milk into powdered milk, then the U.S. gets the full value of the water. Right now, our trade policy is fairly bizarre. We're really a kind of third world country. We export cotton, we receive back shirts. We export hides. We receive back shoes. We export logs. We receive back furniture. Let's use the water to maximize the economic benefit for our own people first.
If you're listening to this interview in your home and you're thinking, gee, what can I do in terms of water management in my own home, what are a few tips you might give Joe and Mary, homeowner?
Oh, gosh, I'm glad you asked that question. Joe and Mary, Robert here. I got two ideas. First, stop using your kitchen food disposal. If you use that unit 2 minutes a day to get rid of food scraps, by the end of the month, you will have used 150 gallons of water. That's water that could be saved. Just throw those food scraps in the garbage or in your compost pile. So that's the first thing. The second thing if you really want to save water, turn off a light. Because researchers at Virginia Tech University have disclosed that a single 60-watt incandescent bulb that burns 12 hours a day will, by the end of the year, use as much as 6,300 gallons of water. So if we're serious about conserving water, let's turn off some lights.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you for being on the show. I've been talking with Robert Glennon, who is a Regents Professor and Morris K. Udall Professor of Law and Public Policy at the University of Arizona. You need to get his book, Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It, published by Island Press. Robert, thank you so much for being a guest on Greening of the Great Lakes.
Thanks for having me on the show.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Whether you're moving across town or across the country, relocating to a new job or a new city is always a challenge. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, wherever you go, you'll have an instant circle of friends on hand to help you get settled and get connected. With more than 100 clubs and affiliates around the world, there's a Spartan in just about every city. And as an MSU Alumni Association member, you'll quickly feel right at home. Wherever you go, community, connections, careers, and class, four great reasons to visit alumni.msu.edu today to activate your membership in the largest Spartan organization in the world. That's alumni.msu.edu, the Michigan State University Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
We're really fortunate in the United States with respect to our food safety, but that doesn't mean we can just rest on our laurels. We can do an even better job, and that's exactly what MSU Ag Bioresearch scientist Dr. Vanji Alosilha does. Dr. Alosilha is a professor of biosystems and agricultural engineering at Michigan State University, and she has developed a new technology that can help protect us from dangerous bacteria in our food supply and our water. Vanji, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for welcoming me, Kirk, in this program. I really appreciate it.
We hear a lot about things like E. coli and Salmonella, threats to human health. Just what are they and how do they get into our water and into our food system?
Okay. E. coli is called really Escherichia coli. These are bacteria that lives in the guts of warm-blooded animals, including humans. And these are needed in our system to help us digest our like vitamins or food or something like that. We need them. But there are some of these organisms that have, shall we say, mutated over a long period of time that have become virulent, and they stay in the guts of cattle or wild animals. And these wild animals, we call them, or cattle, they call them harboring animals. They don't experience, they don't feel anything when these virulent organisms are in their stomach or in their guts. I mean, they just stay there. But when they have feces, or and then these fecal matters are washed into the streams and then or water system, and then these water systems are used for irrigation that affects, that then contaminates our vegetables or fruits or something like that that's close to the ground. And also with this bacteria, when they get into the feces, fecal matters of cattle, and then they are slaughtered, then they are like all over their bodies because of their, you know, the feces in their skin and like that. And if they are not well cleaned, then they are transmitted, then contaminating the ground beef or meats. And so this is how they are basically transmitted throughout the food supply chain.
So let me see if I can get this straight. So I'm a spinach producer in somewhere in the United States. I grow fruits and vegetables. These bacteria get into the water from manure, maybe rainwater, groundwater, surface water.
Right.
I use the water to irrigate my spinach.
Correct.
I may not even know that that water is contaminated,
but that
contaminated water then contaminates the spinach.
Correct.
So, but when the spinach goes through processing, the manufacturing and all that, when it's sterilized, what have you, doesn't that generally kill any of that bacteria that might be in the water originally?
Well, most of our spinach are being washed, but sometimes this bacteria stick to the leaves and stems of the, like, spinach, for this example. And very few of our spinach are irradiated, so they are not killed. So basically, this we are at risk when there are the fruits and vegetables are eaten fresh. Because then you have all these organisms potentially sticking there and could be passed around to people.
So it's more likely in terms of vegetables, if we're eating fresh vegetables, the
risk
is greater than if you're eating processed vegetables, for
example. That's correct.
Okay, so we've got this problem with these bacteria that can be harmful to human beings.
And also some of this bacteria, when they get into, they have some studies where they can be absorbed by the organism, by the plants also.
Absorbed from the groundwater,
from the
groundwater,
right.
So it has nothing to do with the irrigation necessarily, but absorption through the root system.
No, the irrigated system is like contaminated, but then as they grow, they can be absorbed to the system of the plant. I mean, a few studies are shown that they could potentially be absorbed like that.
Okay. So we generally, though, back to our original point, and you would agree with this, we generally do a really good job in the United States with our
food safety. Absolutely,
yeah. But you've developed a technology, you think you call it a biosensor, that's going to even improve our ability to detect these pathogens in our water and in our food.
That's correct.
How does it work?
Okay. I would say that If you are familiar with a glucose meter that people use for a lot of diabetic people use to monitor their glucose concentration or content in the blood, that's an example of a successful biosensor in the market. So a biosensor is designed where you have a biological receptor that is designed to target whatever materials you want to identify. And these biological receptors are connected directly to a what we call transducer. Mm-hmm. Now, these transducer materials could be like nanomaterials, nanoparticles. Anyway, the interaction between the receptor and the target is converted to some form of an electronic signal, which is very instant, which is instantaneous, very quick, and which is what the glucose meter really is, mm-hmm. right? You monitor the glucose. When there is glucose, immediately you see a signal that says, like, this is the glucose level you have, a concentration you have in your blood, and so on and so forth. So it's just like that. And so it's instantaneous. It's simple to use. It's small. Response is very quick. But it is designed for quick screening. So you can, anyone who could be able to, like, operate a glucose meter should be able to also to operate eventually a biosensor, because these are in the same category of that kind of device.
So Benji, let's go back to our original example with the spinach grower. This is a handheld device,
That's
as I
correct.
Understand it.
Uh-huh.
So a grower can go out and use this handheld device, and what do? They collect a sample of their irrigation water or something?
Yes, you can get a rinsate. Mm-hmm. Either a sample of your irrigation water or a rinsate of your spinach, and then you get a certain volume, very small volume of the sample, and we add our reagents, and then once the reagent is magnetic, there are magnetic nanoparticles in there. So basically, say for example, a receptor in this case, maybe an antibody to E. coli, O157A7, which is the organism that is virulent. This antibody is connected to a magnetic nanoparticle. So when the antibody interacts with the E. coli O157A7 bacteria, then you pull it with a magnet. So everything is pulled out by the magnetic nanoparticle that has the antibody on it, right? So now you have a magnetic nanoparticle with the antibody and with the E. coli all in the same complex, and you pull it out with a simple magnet and you remove the organism from the system. Then you put a buffer, a little bit of buffer, and then you put the second reagent that has the signal amplifier in it, which we use gold nanoparticles as signal amplifier, and then you put them into your biosensor chip, and then it registers a signal that says, yes, there is
some contamination.
Contamination, right.
And as I understand it, I mean, this is not only, you said this before, this is a quick test, but it's also very inexpensive compared to more traditional means of detecting these bacteria.
Right. Let's look at this in perspective. The conventional way of determining this bacteria is by plating method, which takes about 48 to 72 hours. Mm. Whereas our biosensor can detect from sample processing to detection in about 50 to 60 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So there's a big difference.
At
in
a price
time.
Of what? Maybe.
And then the price for conventional testing is about $25 to $35 mm. per test. For our biosensor, at least for the material cost, we can bring it down to maybe $2.
Wow, that's amazing.
For material cost. So,
well, let's talk a little bit. Another exciting dimension is that you're commercializing this biosensor right
that's
now,
correct.
And there's a really neat partnership between MSU Technologies and MSU Foundation and a Grand Rapids-based Michigan Accelerator Fund. A little bit about the commercialization with the company that you've helped create.
Okay, so these technologies now, we have developed them in the lab. And so these are like small scale. Mm-hmm. Now the commercialization company will now bring it up to upscale and look at all the parameters, whether they are still true in terms of scale up of the parameters, and then move it to commercialization. And the target market is food safety and biodefense type of markets.
So here's a classic example of where the discoveries in the laboratory find their way into the marketplace and success, creating jobs and economic development as well.
Absolutely correct. Right. Absolutely correct. Right.
Well, what an exciting development. As this thing becomes commercialized, Vanji, maybe we can get you back on the show to talk a little bit about
how
it's
going. Oh, thank you. I really appreciate this. This is a great opportunity. Yes.
Uh-huh. I've been talking with Dr. Vanji Alosilha, a professor of biosystems and agricultural engineering at Michigan State University, and she, along with her colleagues, have developed a new technology that helps protect us from dangerous bacteria in our food and in our water. Vanji, thanks so much for being on Greening of the Great Lakes.
I really appreciate this time, Kirk. Thank you.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
The program is MSU Today. I'm Scott Westerman from the Michigan State University Alumni Association with some observations on the Spartan life. Commencement for our latest graduating class will be here before we know it. We'll soon launch another group of newly minted Spartans into the real world to seek their fortunes. So, how do you start something new? When I visit with alumni who are about to embark on a fresh adventure, this quote seems to resonate. There are always two voices sounding in our ear, the voice of fear and the voice of confidence. One is the clamor of the senses, the other is the whispering of the higher self. Charles B. Newcomb. Few things are more exciting than watching a baby take his first steps. We record the requisite video after he's figured it out and show it proudly to everyone we know. What we forget is what happened before we turned on the camera. How he crawled, stood, fell, crawled some more, stood again, fell again, and kept doing it until he learned how to take those first tentative steps. Even after he gets it down, what happens? He falls again. It's only through sheer will, repeated practice, and the continual encouragement of people we care about that new skills are practiced and perfected. This is the case whenever we try something new. By now, our spring crop of Spartan seniors have mostly launched into the real world. Here's a taste of the feedback loop I hear every year at this time. This was harder than I thought it would be. This is not what I expected. I'm not sure this is the career I want after all. I feel in over my head. What happens if I screw up? Well, whether you're starting something new or are contemplating expanding your current horizons, here are some thoughts to keep in mind as you approach a growth opportunity. If it was easy, everybody would be doing it. Success belongs to the people who can stay with a skill until they get good at it. You will experience obstacles, often right at the finish line. It's how you approach obstacles that will determine how quickly you will achieve what you seek. Everything is harder than it looks. People are quick to judge others until they have put their own skin into the game. From politics to the athletic field, the world is full of Monday morning quarterbacks who will shoot you down and second-guess everything from your skills to your motives. At some point in your career, you will work for a Monday morning quarterback. Ignore the negativity and prove yourself by your actions. You will make mistakes, sometimes big mistakes. This is how you learn. Mistakes and failure are essential to human growth. It's okay to make them. Productive people are likely to make them more often because they attempt more things that are outside of their comfort zone. One of the most inspiring scenes in the film Chariots of Fire is the race where Eric Little is tripped up in the opening turn. The film switches to slow motion, and we see him struggle to his feet, setting his eyes on the runners ahead of him. He gets back in the race, catches the pack, and is ultimately victorious in spite of his fall. There are only a couple of situations where failing becomes real trouble, if you don't learn from it, or if you let it deter you from your goal. You must do what you said you would do. This means showing up every day on time and ready to work, not hungover, not unprofessionally dressed, not unprepared. You were hired to add value, to solve problems. This means offering constructive feedback with solutions attached. Keep your promises. Do a little more than what is asked. No complaining allowed. At the end of the day, it's all about results. Always be honest. Achievement means nothing if you cheat. Play fair. Tell the truth.
people will ultimately admire you for it. Honesty demonstrates character, and you won't have to remember any other versions of your story. There will always be someone who is better at what you do than you are. That's why the best athletes are always in training. They believe that there is continually room for improvement. Seek out elite role models. Serve them. Learn from them. Incorporate the best of who they are into the best of who you are. And there will always be someone out there who would love to be in your situation. People don't give jobs. They invest in problem solvers. And you must earn the privilege of serving in the capacity you have chosen every single day. Long-term success never happens when you try to take shortcuts. There is no substitute for seasoning, the word I like to use that combines experience with wisdom. Pace yourself. Be patient, but persistent. Keep your eye on your goals, but don't miss the opportunities that may appear in your peripheral vision. Sometimes the road to success includes a few side trips. And now, the best-kept secret about success. It's much easier to achieve than you might think because few people have the guts to go the extra mile. That's where the money is. That's where the opportunities lie. That's where you'll find your best friends. That's where happiness lives. And the extra mile starts early. U.S. News and World Report quotes a study that notes, self-professed morning people reported feeling happier and healthier than night owls. Society caters to a morning person's schedule. Once we hit the office, the day has a way of getting away from us. So do your planning the night before and write it down on a to-do list. Get a full night's sleep. Schedule your workout before you go to work. Eat a good breakfast. Tackle the big projects first thing in the morning. These are just a few suggestions for getting ahead of the day. One of my faves is check in with your boss and/or team members every morning. You're setting the bar for others, and it can be a great way to catch potential issues early while there's still enough day left to react. Anything worth learning requires repetition. You will not get it right the first time. And that's the rub. The major difference between children and adults is this. We grown-ups don't want to look bad. We don't want people to see us fail. Most of us already secretly believe that we don't deserve our good fortune. We're afraid our rookie mistakes will confirm that, and our dreams will evaporate like raindrops on hot concrete. Banish these unreasonable fears from your mind. Buckle down, point yourself toward your goals, and start deliberately and tenaciously in that direction. Even when you move from crawling to walking and finally to running, you will take an occasional spill. Do your best Eric Little impression. Get back up and keep running. That's how beginners become experts. I'm Scott Westerman, head servant at the MSU Alumni Association. Learn more about your personal network for life at alumni.msu.edu.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Visit us online at spartanpodcast.com.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at spartanpodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.